Hello and welcome to New Books in History. My name is Christine Lamberson and I'll be your host today. Today I'm speaking with Jason Pierce, who's an associate professor at Angelo State University, and we will be talking about his new book, Making the White Man's West, Whiteness and the Creation of the American West, which just came out in 2016 with the University Press of Colorado. Welcome, Jason. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Great. So I want to start by just talking a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in becoming a historian. So what brought you to this great profession?
Well, that's a good question. I grew up in southwestern Colorado, and we had a lot of kind of interesting historical things nearby. You know, we had a lot of Native American sites like Mesa Verde National Park, where we would always go to for, you know, every year's field trip was like, load all the kids up and go to Mesa Verde. So that was fun. And there were a lot of, you know, mining sites and things like that in the area. So, you could kind of sense, kind of feel the history around you, I guess. And so that must have been where I got interested in it, I guess.
Okay, great. And so your book is about the West, and your book talks a lot about how, as the title says, how the West became seen as a kind of white man's paradise, might be an overstatement, but at least a white man's country. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you got interested in this topic, how you came to this book project.
Well, some of it came about just trying to figure out what I wanted to do for my dissertation in college, you know, talking to my advisor and running some ideas. And mostly his eyes were sort of glazed over when I mentioned some other ideas. And then I mentioned this one about looking at, you know, why the West is kind of created or sort of mythologized as being the perfect place for the white man, you know, this sort of last best place kind of idea. You know, why do you have places like Idaho sort of equated with white supremacy? How did all of this stuff kind of come about? And he was really excited about that topic, and it was one that I'd been kind of kicking around in various ways. For example, when I grew up in southwestern Colorado, we had a few Native American kids in my school, and we had a few Hispanic kids, but we only had one black kid. And when I was a little, you know, elementary school kid on the bus, I remember him telling us that he was actually born white, and then he turned into, you know, he got this disease and it turned to black, and we were like, oh my gosh, can that happen? And we were all freaked out. And, you know, as I got older, I, you know, started to think about what must have been like for this guy. You know, he'd been adopted by a family, and he was, you know, the only African-American kid probably within a 100-mile radius. And, you know, and why was that? Why was the area that I grew up in, you know, so overwhelmingly, you know, probably 95% white? And so in some ways, I guess I'd been kind of thinking about these issues, you know, for years and years and years, and then thought, well, you know, look at it as a historian, look at how did this come about, and why is this section of the country so much different than the other parts of it? So I think that's where it sort of came from in a way. So.
Great. And so you have a fascinating story about that. I was wondering, before we kind of dive into that story and how that did come to be, if you could talk a little bit about what we're talking about when we talk about the West, since, of course, that definition changes over time and it's different, you know, today than it has been in the past. And also, when we think about the West, we often think about something very different in the image in our mind for somewhere like Colorado versus somewhere like California, for instance. So what part of the West are you talking about here?
Well, I definitely had a kind of expansive view. I mean, I kept it as pretty much the Trans-Mississippi West. But you're right. I mean, there are a lot of arguments that historians have made about, you know, what is the West, all the subregions of the West. The Pacific Coast is vastly different than Texas, and, you know, Wyoming is different from Utah even, and so there's a lot of debate about that. But I kind of thought that, you know, there's this process of settlement beginning after 1803 with the purchase of the Louisiana Territory that kind of continues on through the rest of the century in some way. And so the process of settling the West, the people were, you know, somewhat, maybe not homogenous, but they were certainly Anglo-Americans. But the process is a little different. When you come into the Southwest, into Texas and California, you're going to be encountering a much more, you know, entrenched population of Hispanic peoples that have been there for a very long time. So that's a lot different than, say, Minnesota, where you're going to see people coming in, mostly Scandinavians, who are coming in as Indian peoples are being displaced and moved west. So there is a definite, you know, there are some sub-geographic distinctions and things like that. But for me, you know, I wanted to see how this process unfolds. But there is a kind of distinction. You get a sense of the northern states, the Dakotas, Montana, those places, as kind of utterly dominated by Anglo-Americans or peoples of northern European ancestry settling in the West. And then in the Southwest, there's these same people, you know, the people, Anglo-Americans moving into that area did have to take into account the racial diversity of California in particular, but Texas, New Mexico, those places as well. And so it does, there are some differences in how this plays out in the different regions.
Okay. So you're telling a story about the 19th century, and you're telling a story about this Trans-Mississippi West. So what does this area look like on the ground? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about how this image comes to be and why in some ways it might be counterintuitive.
Okay, yeah, well, great questions. So I begin roughly basically in 1803, because that's the moment the United States acquires the Louisiana Territory, starts looking to go beyond its borders, you know, that it's created, or it has at its moment of creation. And so obviously Thomas Jefferson's playing a big role in that whole process. And he really looks to the West and has this grand vision of what the West is going to be, this empire of liberty that he talks about. And he's got this plan to send all these little yeoman farmers, these hardworking, small, white family farmers out there to colonize all these places. And it's going to be this just fabulous place, you know, take 1,000 years to settle, he thinks, yeah, and all of that kind of stuff. And so this will be a way to kind of perpetuate, Jefferson thinks, American democracy in the decades and even centuries to come, that we, you know, we won't have to worry about us becoming like the Europeans, working in factories, all that kind of stuff. But so he's got this big vision, but the problem is he kind of bumps up against reality, or what appears to be reality, very quickly. And that is when they start sending expeditions to go out to this place, they come back with some pretty dismal reports. Lewis and Clark, not as much, but you have Zebulon Pike, later, you know, Stephen Long. These guys are going out there, coming back and saying, ah, man, there's nothing out here. It's just a wasteland. It's a desert for untold miles. And, you know, they claim to see vast sand dunes in eastern Colorado and all these things, you know, comparing it to the Sahara Desert. Well, all of that then kind of puts Jefferson's idea, calls it into question. You know, is this really going to be a place that people can go and settle? Increasingly, it looks like it's not. So what do you do with it then? And at first, they come up with some ideas, one of which is to use this to kind of racially purify the nation. So there are various schemes to move free African Americans, and maybe perhaps someday all African Americans, maybe out to somewhere in this West. There's plans to create an all-black state where you could settle all these people, and then you wouldn't have them, you know, in the United States or in the rest of the country. You know, you could kind of purify them. The same thing, of course, with Native Americans. Let's move them all out of the East and give them time to be civilized, all that, you know, and adapt it to our ways and all that, you know, justification that Indian removal has. Well, the idea then is that we can kind of keep these groups kind of on the edge of everything, away from the Republic, you know, the central part of the Republic and all of that. It kind of never happens. Obviously, African Americans are never sent in large numbers to some state out in the Trans-Mississippi West. And in fact, eventually the movement really focuses on a kind of return to Africa, you know, the founding of Liberia, all that stuff. But Native Americans are moved, of course, to Indian territory, sending them out there to try to kind of not only get access to their land, but also to remove this kind of this element of the population that, you know, is sort of anomalous, doesn't seem to fit the views of citizenship, all that kind of stuff. And so for a while, then it looks like that's what the West is going to be. And people go out there, Washington Irving goes out there. He comes back with nothing good to say about it. He talks about how this is going to be nothing but a kind of American, Siberia, or a kind of American, Arabia, where you're just going to have these wandering groups of sort of racially mixed people, preying on settlers and things like that. And so it looks like for a while that that's what the West is going to be, that the West is just going to be this kind of dumping ground for the people that we don't want in the rest of our republic. And that continues on until people start settling in Texas, Anglo-Americans start going into Texas, and of course the Mexican-American War. And shortly after that, the discovery of gold in California. And then that changes the dynamic completely. So that's kind of the first period of what I think, is going on there. So,
okay, so suddenly there's gold out there and everybody wants to go west, despite the fact it had been, these Native American land, or had been supposedly being reserved to be Native American land. So once they rush out there, then this poses a problem that you have all these Native Americans, both from a, practical point of view, but then also from an ideological point of view. So what happens there?
Right. So suddenly what was supposed to be, right, they're supposed to be on the outside looking in, is how one, guy puts it, but instead suddenly Indian territory and all the Indians, like the Lakota, Comanches, all of these people that we're supposed to always be out there and just kind of on the edges. Well, suddenly they're right smack in the middle of the heart of this now continental nation after the Mexican-American War. And so, what are we going to do about that is going to be a continuing question that we're going to wrestle with. The other question then is to try to reverse this idea that the West is this wasteland that's, ill-suited to Anglo civilization, because, Washington Irving, among others, had said, we're never going to be able to settle this place. Other people had gone out and especially to places like California, Texas, New Mexico, gone out there and visited, or part of, maybe the hide trade or part of the Santa Fe trade. And then they had come back and said, well, actually the weather is really amazingly fantastic out here. It's this really great place, but actually it's probably too nice. And if we move out here, we're going to end up being just as lazy as all the Mexicans that you see in San Antonio or Los Angeles. And supposedly, the great weather had transformed them into this kind of not vigorous, kind of torpid, kind of stupid group of people. And the fear then is that, well, if we go and settle these places, we're going to become just like them. And so, once again, there's this fear of the West as ill-suited to Anglo-American settlement. Well, coming to the rescue of that, to that idea, I guess, are a group of scientists who are very influential in the 1840s called the polygenesists. And these guys, basically say, well, we don't need to worry about what the Indians are like or what the Mexicans are like, because we believe that people were actually created in different places at different times. And so, the Indians were created separately from white people in a separate creation. So rather than arguing for a kind of unified creation and then people sort of distributing from a central point of genesis, they're talking that there were multiple places where people had emerged. Some guys like Louis Agassiz, a Swiss scientist who comes to the United States, quickly establishes himself as probably America's most famous scientist. He compares Native Americans and European Americans to bears and tigers, and he says if you look at both of them, they both have claws and fangs, but they're not the same species. They're completely different animals. And so the upshot of all of that then is that Anglos can go to the West, conquer the West, conquer the peoples in the West, and be assured that we wouldn't become lazy and torpid just because the weather was better. So now they start to build up this idea that perhaps, the West is with the better, superior weather can actually be good for Anglo-Americans, that finally, after centuries of battling cold weather and all these terrible things, we can use our ingenuity to to, you know, turn it loose and create the best civilization the world has ever seen. And so you get promoters like Charles Fletcher Lummis, who's talking about that, you know, saying, you know, once you put, you know, Anglo ingenuity in this great climate, we're going to do things, invent things, and expand in a way that nobody has ever seen before. And so they kind of reinvent the West to make it seem like the perfect place for Anglo-American settlement. Whereas just a few decades before, the fear was that this was a place that we shouldn't go. And so it's a kind of intellectual gymnastics that really leads to kind of complete reversal in the idea of the suitability of this, of these regions for settlement. So,
yeah, the discussion of the weather was really one of my favorite parts of your book. I love this idea of that we're all going to be lazy as long as the weather is good.
Right. Yeah.
So exactly. They're doing this kind of they're conducting this new ideological project. So how are they doing this? And perhaps to put this in a different way, kind of thinking about your book, what sort of sources are you looking at, and how are they actually conducting this kind of culture building or remaking of an intellectual project on such a broad scale, right? How are they accomplishing that? Where do you see that? What kind of sources are you looking at to find out about that?
Well, there are a bunch. I mentioned Charles Fletcher Lummis, and he kind of sees himself as sort of the archetype of this this whole project. He goes west in 1885. He walks from Chillicothe, Ohio, all the way to Los Angeles, in part because it's a publicity stunt to kind of raise people's awareness of who he is. He's going to work at the Los Angeles Times, and so he walks the whole way. By this time, of course, you could take the train. In fact, his wife meets him up at various places, you know, Denver and places like that. But he decides to walk. Because he will, you know, part of it is he's a kind of an acolyte of that Teddy Roosevelt idea of the strenuous life, that a real man does these real manly things, and partially it's promotion, and the other reason I think is he's trying to kind of get a sense of this region, and you do see a kind of transformation as he goes from Ohio to Los Angeles. You know, at first he calls himself a sort of narrow-minded Yankee, and he sees the Indians as sort of backwards. At one point, he goes to a village in southern Colorado of Hispanics, and he makes fun of the food they eat and how spicy it is, and he makes a joke that's something to the effect that, you know, a coyote will not touch the flesh of a dead greaser because it's so stuffed with all the pepper they eat, and, you know, he thinks that's really funny. And then he sends a letter back talking about all this stuff. And then the very next letter he writes, the next time he gets to a post office several weeks later, he recants all of this and says, you know, my last letter, I was an idiot. You know, I've come to understand that these people are actually, you know, really pretty nice, and they've helped me, and their culture is interesting, all this. So he kind of changes his view. Now, he never changes the fact that he's, in a sense, superior to all of these groups, but he finds Indian cultures fascinating and Hispanic culture fascinating and all of those things, but he does become a kind of popularizer of the idea of the West as this kind of best place for Anglo-Americans to settle, in particular California. And so he'll spend his time at the Los Angeles Times, and especially when he becomes editor of the Land of Sunshine magazine, kind of promoting California as this sort of idyllic place for Anglo-Americans to settle. And then he's not alone. You see other people kind of, a lot of these are promoters, you know, obviously, who have a kind of self-interest in encouraging people to come out to the West as well. So another guy I talk about a lot is the founder of the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad, Palmer. And Palmer writes some letters back to his fiance, trying to convince her and his, and more importantly, his mother-in-law, to let her move out to Colorado in the 1870s. You know, because there's this, well, what about Indians, or, you know, are you gonna get killed? And he's basically saying, you know, don't worry about the Indians, and we're building up this amazing culture out here. You know, a chance to kind of create the perfect society from sort of whole cloth. You know. And so he writes back basically saying, you know, you don't need to worry about the savages out here in the West because there really aren't any that you need to worry about. And the real place of savagery, he claims, is the East Coast, where all these, you know, immigrants are coming in from Southern and Eastern Europe who are not compatible with American society. That's the real, what he calls, briny border of America. So in other words, you know, the East is sort of doomed. They're letting in all of these undesirable people, people who can also, because they're, you know, considered white, even though they're Italians or Greeks or Poles or whatever, they can vote, but they're not really compatible with what it means to be an American. Whereas in the West, Anglo-Americans can kind of rule without challenge because Indians, of course, do not have rights. Mexican-Americans, for the most part, with some exceptions in New Mexico, really don't have any political power either. Chinese, which are, you know, the only large Chinese population in the countries in the Pacific Coast as well, but they too are denied any rights. And so, you know, we Anglo-Americans are sort of unchallenged at the pinnacle of power and don't have to worry about these immigrants coming in and taking their power away the way it appears that's happening, say, on the East Coast. And so this is kind of whole, you know, selling promotion of this idea of this kind of perfect, society that they're developing out there.
Okay. So I have a couple of questions kind of continuing on from there. One is to think a little bit about how much this is a story of, you know, building the West and having these desirable features in the West that didn't need to be somehow rewritten as acceptable, right? The weather is desirable, which we used to think was bad, and now we have to make that okay. We used to see this as a place, you know, for Native Americans, but now there's gold, so we need to somehow, you know, make it into a place for Anglo-Americans. So how much of this is a rewriting of the story for a pull factor? But then there's also this really important factor of what's going on in the East, the kind of the push factor. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how those two fit together and kind of their relative weight, maybe?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's an excellent question. So there's a couple of the push factors that are really kind of contributing to this. A little bit earlier, in the 1840s, especially the 1850s, the pull factor has to do with what's going on, or I'm sorry, the push factor, the reasons to leave, have to do in part with what's going on in the rest of the country. Of course, the 1850s are this incredibly divisive period where the nation is starting to tear itself apart, especially over, you know, of slavery and the expansion of slavery and all that kind of stuff. And so the two states that are admitted to the Union from the West, or the far West at least, in that decade are California and Oregon. And both of those try to get completely out of this debate. And they try to do this by saying, we're going to be free states. We don't want to come in, we don't want slavery. But they also say, but we also don't want any African Americans either. And so they try to just get away from this entire argument that's tearing the country apart by saying, you know, we're so far away, we're not going to have slavery, but we're not going to let black people live here either. Problem solves, and so on. So in that part, you know, there's this pull. Again, it's this idea of creating this perfect society and learning from the supposed mistakes of the East, and that means slavery in the South and also the presence of free African Americans. They don't want either of those things, so they're going to try, and they do try, both states do try very hard to not have either slavery or a free black population. So it's a chance to sort of break from the problems that they see, or as they see it, you know, that are tearing the country apart. So you get that part, and then a little bit later, in the 1870s, 1880s, you know, and beyond, when you start to really see an influx of immigrants coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, you know, there's a lot of debate in America that will really last until the 1920s when we pass the 1924 Immigration Act that sets up the quota system, you know. Before that, though, there's all this debate. Should we be letting in Italians and Greeks and Poles? Many of them are not Protestants. Most of them, you know, they're ethnically different. Their culture's different. Their language is different. They tend to, you know, clump together into ethnic neighborhoods, and they don't want to assimilate into American society, and they're or scientists, especially eugenicists, running around telling everybody, you know, well, this is this is going to lead to demographic collapse, that guys like Charles Benedict Davenport are saying, you know, if you look at 200 sons of Harvard graduates and then 200 sons of immigrants, well, the immigrants are going to go on to have, you know, 10 kids each, and then the sons of the Harvard graduates are going to only have one or two, and this is going to create this terrible population of, you know, degenerate people that will have the numbers to control America, and there's all this kind of alarmist sort of rhetoric. Well, again, the West is saying, hey, we're not a part of that, this problem. That's you guys on the East. That's Castle Garden, Ellis Island. You know, you guys have to figure that out, because those people don't come out to the West, and the few that do, they make this argument, are more vigorous, more intelligent, willing to brave the hardships of going out to the West. And so there's a kind of process of, you know, like Frederick Jackson Turner talks about, of Americanizing these people as they come to the West, that the better classes of those immigrants are going to come to the West and assimilate, whereas most of them there won't. And so you get a lot of discussion of this. So again, Charles Fletcher Lummis talks a lot about this. Other people as well, guys like Frank Bird Linderman, people like that, who are saying, we don't want all these immigrants coming into our area. And in fact, it's kind of interesting, because about that same period, a lot of these same people, Lummis and Linderman in particular, start really praising Native American cultures and really talking about Native Americans as worthy of being protected, as being remembered as the first Americans. And so suddenly there's this interest in preserving and collecting Native American history and culture, and helping Native Americans establish reservations and things like that. At the same time, they're also saying, well, we don't want all these, you know, Italians and stuff coming into the United States. And so there's a kind of interesting dynamic going on there as well. So
following right from that, so one of the things that's a challenge for this narrative is that there actually are all of these people out there, right? Native Americans, Mexican Americans, Chinese immigrants, etc. So what happens to them? How do they fit into the story? You mentioned that eventually there starts to be a celebration of Native Americans, and historians have talked about once they become less of a threat, that's of course easier to do. But there's still a presence if you're going to be talking about this being right. A white man's yeah. West. So how do they fit in? And I'm curious, kind of both in an ideological sense, if you could talk a bit about that, but then also, and your book talks about the role of violence and the role of power and kind of what it actually means for their lives.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the historian Elliot West has a phrase that kind of captures this, and he says kind of what happens is the people, all of these groups, Native Americans, you know, Mexican Americans, Asian immigrants, they go from being seen as people of color to peoples of local color, so they become a kind of regional distinction. So guys, a reason that the West is so interesting and unique. And so one of the big tourist attractions in California becomes Chinatown and in San Francisco. And so it's this great place to go visit, to get to sort of soak in this exotic culture of the Chinese. And there are postcards you could send back to your folks of opium dens. You could go tour an opium den and see people, you know, gorked out of their mind on opium, and send us back to your parents. And, oh, look, I'm having a great time in California. Or, you know, and kind of going to the old missions in California, or going to a fandango, you know, a Mexican dance in San Antonio or something like that. And you could kind of soak in this color, this local color, and this exoticism of that the West offered, or go to a pueblo and see the, you know, Indians living in their villages and things like that. And so it became one of the unique characteristics of the West. But at the same time, those groups are also dispossessed, and they're dispossessed politically by and large, because they're not eligible for citizenship. Acts like the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act will limit the population of the Chinese. They're not allowed to become citizens, at least the first generation isn't. The 14th Amendment will actually allow Asian immigrants that are born here to become citizens, but that first generation is going to be denied citizenship. Native Americans, for the most part, are denied citizenship. And Hispanics, even though they're under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, they are citizens, there are going to be a variety of mechanisms to keep them from exercising any real political power pretty much everywhere but New Mexico. New Mexico is the only kind of exception where you see Hispanics still having, you know, being elected to political office and stuff like that. And then, of course, one of the mechanisms by which this dispossession happens is violence. And so there's going to be a great deal of violence directed at all of these groups. Obviously, Native Americans are going to be dispossessed and forced onto reservations by military campaigns. But there is a lot of violence directed at the Chinese, a lot of riots all across the West. Rock Springs, Wyoming is one of the worst, but they have riots in Seattle and Tacoma and Denver. And all of these are kind of designed to kind of intimidate and sort of, you know, put these people in kind of a secondary status. Same thing happens in Texas, especially with Mexican Americans who are going to find themselves sort of violently put into a secondary status and often, forced into a kind of a quasi-segregation. There'll be a sort of informal segregation for Mexican Americans across Texas, just as there is for African Americans. And so you can celebrate in the Southwest these distinctive kind of interesting cultures. At the same time, they're not a threat to the dominance of Anglo-Americans the way, say, Italian immigrants in New York are a threat or seen as a threat, you know, back east, where these political machines are taking over. And, of course, those machines are using a lot of the votes of those immigrants to stay in power. And so you don't have that problem out in the West. So that's kind of how that process works.
And so how does this violence fit into that ideology, in the sense it's serving, of course, to actually dispossess these others as they are seen at that moment, mm-hmm. And kind of take away their power so as to keep Anglo-Americans in the positions of political power. But then in some ways, it seems to me like this is also creating sort of that the image of the West as potentially dangerous. How does that actual violence fit into these narratives?
Well, that's a great question. And so the idea, I guess, is that these are sort of temporary, that this is, that law and order will kind of prevail in the end, that, you're safe to go out there and all of that stuff. But in Texas, the Texas Rangers are one of the more controversial groups in Texas history. Of course, they're held up as great heroes fighting against the Indians, you know, fighting against outlaws. And so they're held up generally with great regard in Texas. But at the same time, especially Mexican Americans have this long and very complicated history with the Texas Rangers, or groups that are sort of quasi Texas Rangers, kind of violently attacking and killing people with really very little provocation. And there are outbursts of this where it's at times when it's worse than others. The years of the Mexican Revolution in Texas are particularly violent. There's this great fear of the revolution spilling over into Texas, and there are these, rumored campaigns of, race war. The Plan de San Diego is the big one, where there's a supposedly secret kind of takeover of Texas planned, and so the Rangers will violently crack down on any of those sorts of activities that they think are happening. And so, but it's seen as part of this larger campaign, I guess, of establishing law and order. And so there doesn't seem to be, you do have a few years, Palmer's fiance worrying about coming to Colorado and being attacked by Indians. There's a few, there are some years of that, but really by the time you kind of get into the 1880s, the sense is that it's for most places you're pretty safe. And so that doesn't seem that I found a lot of fear of that. The image, the mythology of the Wild West is still there. And that is something that some of these guys will have to argue against. Charles Fletcher Lummis spends a lot of his time, trying to explain to people that this is actually the most civilized section of the country, and that this is the most modern section of the country. The infrastructure is brand new, and we don't have slums, and we don't have shiftless, people who are you know, sucking off the you know, society or any of that, you know, that it's all hardworking people. And so they do spend some time kind of addressing some of those fears of being somewhat uncouth and backwards and underdeveloped and stuff like that. And so they're constantly touting their technological innovations and all the new, you know, every town praises its new building every, you know, and, oh, we have the most modern, you know, buildings and the, you know, and on and on and on. So they are kind of aware of that, that perception. And so they try to reverse it. They try to say that the real frontier is not the West. The real frontier is the East, with all these, you know, immigrants coming in who are not, you know, indigestible is the term they often use. They can't be assimilated into American culture. So they try to flip that idea kind of on its ear.
So I was wondering also if you might tell us if there was anything you found particularly surprising or any kind of, you know, favorite moments of doing research for this book and kind of figuring out the story and teasing out this process.
One of the interesting ones was when I got here, I inherited a graduate student who just happened to be working on a similar project looking at kind of some of the racial issues in the Contra Valley. He brought in this paper, and he had this fantastic quote, you know, one of those quotes that, like, summed up everything. And so I was like, you know, Matt, can I borrow this quote? This is really amazing. This is, like, been researching this for years, and I haven't found a quote that really encapsulates this as well as this one in his paper. And he's like, oh, yeah. So it was a kind of serendipitous moment. I sort of end up in San Angelo here. And this student is working on a paper about looking at whiteness issues in West Texas and all that kind of stuff. And he found this great quote out of the San Angelo Standard Times, the local newspaper here, and it talks about this parade, and it's this Founders Day parade in San Angelo, which is your typical small town parade. It's 1910. And so it's, you know, local bands and the little floats and, you know, wagons and lots of farm equipment, I'm sure. And then the KKK, you know, water marching down the streets and waving at everybody and all that kind of stuff. And then the paper, you know, says that off to the side was one of the founders of Texas, a Texas Ranger named John W. Long. And the reporter writes, "Few of the great multitudes who witnessed Monday's parade of old-timers were cognizant of the fact that there stood in their midst one of the fathers of Texas." And he talks about how this guy, you know, had fought with Sol Ross at the Battle of Pease River, where they'd rescued or redeemed, is the term they used at the time, Cynthia Ann Parker, who'd been a white woman who'd been living with the Comanches, you know. And then supposedly he was at this battle, which is, you know, this really famous moment in Texas history. Then he goes off to fight for the Confederacy during the war, and, you know, and all this, you know, this hero of Texas. And so the journalist writes, you know, he's kind of reflecting on his career, and Long says, "I fought for years with the Rangers and pioneers to make this a white man's country, and fought 4 years to keep a nigger from being as good as a white man. In the first I went out, in the second I lost, but I glory in the knowledge that West Texas will always be what we fought for, and what the Lord intended it to be, a white man's country." And so there was this phenomenal quote, you know, that my student found that was like, yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. You know, this idea of this mythology that the West is going to be different because it doesn't suffer from these problems, right? That they remove the Indians and, you know, and he, you know, kept all the other groups in kind of a subservient sort of position that kind of summed up. So that was kind of an interesting moment, you know, in the whole process. You know, you find those really great quotes that really kind of sum up stuff, you know, you always kind of jump for joy. And I had another one right there, the book I put into, I kind of compare that quote with Charles Fletcher Lummis, and Lummis has this great quote too, where he writes in the Land of Sunshine about California, and he says, "Our foreign element is a few thousand industrious Chinamen, and perhaps 500 native Californians who do not speak English, the ignorant, hopelessly un-American type of foreigners which infests and largely controls eastern cities is almost unknown here. Poverty and illiteracy do not exist as classes," right? And so here he's hitting that other part about why the West is now actually the superior section of the country to the East, that we don't have these big, profound social problems of poverty and all of those things at the slums of New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and all those places supposedly have. So, you know, you find a few of those. It's always fun, you know, to get somebody who finally says, you know, exactly what you think these people are believing, and people put it to words. And when you do studies on issues of race and stuff, that can be hard to do. And I think it's especially hard the closer you get to our time. So when you're working in the 19th century, you will have guys like the Texas Ranger, you know, long saying exactly what they believe. When you get to doing work in more modern times, people use a lot of codes and things like that. So the 19th century, I think, in some ways is easier to do than, say, the 20th century, because people are much more upfront back then with what they believe, I think, in a lot of ways. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, so you are, you know, at heart interested in the 19th century and at least the early 20th century. But nonetheless, I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about kind of the legacy of this narrative and of this image of the West. I mean, you started out telling us a little bit about your childhood and how that helped contribute to your interest in this. So how has this idea shifted or come down to the present, or come down to us in the present?
Yeah, that's a good one, question. I think I think the truth is it's still there. When you look at the presidential campaigns, when you look at a lot of policy that's been made in the West in the last 20 years or so, there's, I think, a concerted effort in some ways to protect this idea that the white man's West, you know, that the West is still this perfect place for Anglo-Americans, you know, this idea of this sort of last best place, the kind of last stand for true Americanness, you know, maybe in the West, or at least that's the idea that you have, you really see a lot of, you really see it around. You have anti-government types, the Bundy family, of course, is probably most famous, and taking over refuges and things like that. Most of that is not explicitly about race. Mostly it's about the government. But when you dig a scratch a little bit deeper, one of their problems is they think the government does too much to help ethnic minorities and not enough to help the sort of beleaguered white man, you know, who's the man who made America what it is and has worked hard and never asked for a handout and is independent, all that kind of stuff. And then you have, you know, these minority groups that, well, they just, you know, are on the government dole and all. So you start to see some of that kind of rhetoric kind of being pulled out. You also see that reflected in policy. California in the 90s passed laws that wouldn't allow children of illegal immigrants to get access to public assistance of public programs of various sorts. You've seen efforts like in Arizona to mandate driver's licenses, to allow people to policemen to pull over drivers and ask about their immigration status and where they're from. Obviously, that's mostly going to be Hispanic peoples that are going to be questioned about their status, and of course most famously and unrealistically, Donald Trump's massive wall. That this is the solution to preserving America and the West. Right? This, it seems like a great simple solution, and after all, it's a wall. You know, it's tangible, it's concrete. Let's build this thing, and so let's protect America from these immigrants coming in and all of that stuff. And so it's still there. And I think the West is still seen as this sort of white man's refuge. You know, I make a reference there to Mark Furman at the beginning, the cop in the O.J. Simpson case, who was, kind of discredited because he was ostensibly a racist, right? Well, he quits the LAPD, and where does he go? Well, he moves to Sandpoint, Idaho, which is the stronghold of the Aryan Nations, and everyone kind of shrugs their shoulders and says, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense, you know? And so there's still this idea, right, that this part of the country is different, especially the Pacific Northwest. And the Aryan Nations has long talked about, you know, this idea of a homeland for white people, that this is they had at one point talked about taking the Pacific Northwest and kind of separating it from the rest, seceding from the United States and creating this kind of utopian, racist, white man society up there, So yeah, so I think it's an idea that's still very much around, and I think it's a national idea. You know, the sense Trump, of course, is drawing most of his support from whites, middle class whites and lower class whites, many of whom are worried about their social status, to feel like they haven't ever benefited from what's going on in American society, that welfare programs are helping minorities, and that they're being kind of screwed over on that side, but also by wealthier people. And so there's this sense of a kind of racial anger, I think, that's really kind of running through the election. But when you get to the West, there's a kind of Western dimension to that, focusing on dislike of the federal government, and this legacy of viewing this region as kind of racially a sort of homeland or something.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way in which, I know at the beginning you said you're not as interested in these sort of definitional boundary drawing battles, but is there a way in which in some ways maybe today the idea of the West that is this sort of stronghold has shrunk in some ways? Because, I mean, it strikes me you're talking a lot about how these ideas persist, but they also have a beleaguered nature to them, right? There's kind of a feeling that they are not... or that the white man's West might be in trouble on some level, maybe you might be a way to think about it. And it seems like somewhere like California has passed these laws, but on the other hand, it's also incredibly diverse and has lots and lots of immigrants and racial diversity.
Absolutely.
And that's part of its character as well. And in some ways that, Idaho also has an image of people off in bunkers being, protecting themselves.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. And California was the first of the Western states in the 90s to lose the white racial majority. So before that, non-Hispanic whites were more than 50% of the population in the 90s, and there was a great deal of discussion about this. While whites are still the largest single group, they don't comprise more than 50% of the population. And so now California has a very, very large population of Asians. This is a very, very large population of Hispanic peoples, a sizable population of African Americans. And so it is diverse, and there is no white, there's no majority. You're just as likely to see somebody of any other. So it's very much a kind of cosmopolitan, multiracial society. And, it was kind of interesting when I was doing research on this in California and reading all this stuff, and then when I was done doing research, I'd go get dinner or a latte or something, and you could really see the tangible results of that. You could see the racial diversity. You could go down the street and hear Korean or Farsi or Spanish or all these different languages being spoken. And so for this idea, and you see some people talking about this, the idea is that you're right that this is it's shrinking, that it's declining, that there are places that are now irredeemable. And it's not coincidental that in the 90s you see a massive population movement of middle and upper-class whites out of California. Hundreds of thousands leave in the 90s and by and large settle in the Intermountain West. So there's this big period of immigration where people are leaving California, moving to places like Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho. Now, part of that is economics. You could sell your house in Los Angeles for $800,000, go to Colorado or Wyoming and buy a much, much nicer house with that same amount of money. And so you see a lot of people doing that. But there's a sense, especially after the riots in 1992, was 92 or 91, the kind of Los Angeles riots and things like that, that it was time to move. And so you do see this big immigration in that period. But other states are following California. I mean, Texas is moving towards not having a white racial majority. Arizona is very close to doing the same thing, Nevada as well. And so there are these demographic changes, especially in the Southwest, that are happening. And so it is sort of contracting the area that you see sort of set aside, this idea of this white man's, kind of promised land is sort of declining. But and probably will continue to do so until it looks like it'll be kind of that you know, intermountain states, Idaho and maybe Montana, and those places will be kind of probably the last stand of that idea. So it's probably an idea that will eventually become, you know, a kind of artifact, hopefully, because I think having a multiracial society is much better than a society of racial stratification, which is kind of what they were hoping to kind of create here. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's great. So with that, we've taken quite a bit of your time. So could you tell us just what you're working on now?
Well, I don't know. One obvious thing would be I end this in 1924, and then to continue it up more to the present, but as mentioned, I think the closer you get, the harder it is to really get at what's going on. So I thought I could have a second sort of a sequel, you know, or whatever, a second book kind of unmaking the White Man's West, looking at those issues we've just been talking about and how this sort of collapses and what the ramifications of that are and so on. And so that might be a possibility. You know, you spend 10 years working on something, sometimes you want to do something else for a while. So I'm also doing a lot of research on the Texas frontier and violence in the Texas frontier and stuff like that. So maybe I'll do something along those lines too. But I don't know, you know, see what happens next. But.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you for talking to us today. And it's a great book. I enjoyed reading it.
Well, thanks. It's been fun talking with you, Christine. So.